addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
According to the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE, President Trump has declared war on federal workers. What is the largest federal government union doing to protect federal workers? The Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition has won another victory against the Housing Opportunities Commission. What is the relationship between HOC spending on lawyers and the people who desperately need shelter? You will hear from the lead attorney for BACC and victims of HOC. Stay tuned. Morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm your host, Dr. Marcia Adebayo, and I'm with you the fourth Wednesday of each month. Our first guest is attorney Steve Lieberman. Steve has been on the show a number of times. He is a brilliant and creative attorney. He's the lead attorney for BACC on Moses Cemetery, Parcel 175, which is the section of the burial ground located under a parking lot. He recently won a historic decision in front of the Maryland Supreme Court, not only for BACC, but for communities across the country, fighting to stop developers and local governments from desecrating sacred African burial grounds. He's a partner at Rothwell Figg in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Marcia. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, thanks for being on the show again. We always love to find out what's really going on behind the scenes with the litigation. Could you summarize for our listeners who have not necessarily heard about this historic struggle to save an African burial ground in Bethesda, Maryland? Could you summarize the history, both the history of the burial ground as well as the litigation history of Moses African Cemetery?
Sure. Many people in Montgomery County don't know this, but before the Civil War, there were three slave labor camps just off of River Road in the Bethesda area. After the Civil War and the liberation of the people who have been enslaved, there grew up a vibrant African-American community in the River Road area. And as happens with every community, people are born and people die. And when people died, they were buried, many of them, in the Moses Cemetery, just off of River Road. There were, as best the records reflect, over 200, maybe as many as 300 or 400 people who were buried in that burial ground. In the late 1960s, there was an apartment tower constructed just above the burial ground, and the burial ground was paved over for a parking lot. Bulldozers knocked down the tombstones. All traces of the burial ground were obliterated. And when during the construction, body parts kept popping up from the ground, inconveniently for the developers, the decision was made to simply encase the entire burial ground in asphalt, which is what was done. And since 1968 or so, cars have parked on top of that burial ground virtually every day. When you had come to us back in 2021, we had brought on your behalf and on behalf of the pastor of the Macedonia Baptist Church and three descendants of people buried under that parking lot, a lawsuit against the owner of the property, the Montgomery County Housing Opportunities Commission. Because despite knowing for years that the parking lot had 200 or more bodies under it, they refused to do anything about it. They refused to convert the parking lot into some sort of a memorial. They refused to reconstitute the burial ground. They refused to do anything. So we brought a lawsuit, and the case went on for several years, ending up in the Supreme Court of Maryland, where the Supreme Court of Maryland, in a historic decision last August, found that that the descendants of people buried in that burial ground and others with an interest in the burial ground could bring claims, claims in equity and also legal claims against the owner of the property if there was desecration of the bodies going on. And there was a very funny name given to the principal equitable claim, a violation of the right of sepulcher. Right of sepulcher is the right that a person when dead has to be treated with dignity, for the grave to be treated with dignity, not to be dug up, not to be abused, not to be paved over, not to be subject to, you know, having dogs excrete on top of the burial ground or people play on top of the burial ground. And the Maryland Supreme Court said that we could go back to the trial court in Montgomery County and we could assert those claims that the Maryland Supreme Court had recognized. So we did that, and we filed with the court a what's called a motion for leave to amend our complaint to add these new claims. Now, what would you expect from the Montgomery County Housing Opportunities Commission? It's an organization that is supposed to be acting in the public interest, and in some respects they do. I mean, they provide low-income housing, and that's very important. But you would think that when faced with this issue, they would say, you know what? Now that it's been found that there are 200 bodies under this parking lot, we feel uncomfortable continuing to have cars parked there. We feel that it's wrong to do that. But they were profiting from the parking lot. Every month they were charging people for the right to park there. And so when we filed our motion, they opposed the motion. What they said was, among other things, we shouldn't be allowed to bring the claims now because there was an inexcusable delay by the Black community in the area in bringing these claims. That back in the 1968, 1969, the 1970s, that community should have brought a lawsuit against the developer. Now, the evidence is that at that time, as people know, Montgomery County was very, very different than it is now. There was a lot of Ku Klux Klan activity. There were attacks by the Ku Klux Klan on Black residents in the area. There were beatings. There were threats of lynchings. It was an area that was legally and practically segregated, with restrictive covenants preventing the sale of property in the area, not only to people who were Black, but to Jews and in some cases to Catholics as well. It was an intensely segregated area. But the Housing Opportunities Commission said that we should be barred from amending the complaint because there was this inexcusable delay. So we explained to the court why the delay was not inexcusable and why we should be allowed to bring the claims. And on February 11th, the Montgomery County Circuit Court, the trial level court, granted our motion for leave to amend because the interests of justice required that we be allowed to amend. Meaning the court said these claims should be able to proceed in accordance with the ruling of the Supreme Court of Maryland. So we've amended the complaint. And of course, what would you expect from HOC to do at that point?
I would assume that call you and say, Steve, can we sit down and talk?
One would think that would be their reaction. But we got a call from them, an email from them last week saying, we're going to file a motion to dismiss your new claims.
Now, where is all this money coming from? I mean, this is an agency, Steve, that is supposed to provide housing to people who need, you know, low-income housing. But they're spending a lot of money. I mean, this is not cheap in terms of the litigation. This is not cheap. Where is this money coming from? Is this coming from our tax dollars?
Yeah, I don't know. It could be coming from our tax dollars. It could be coming from the rents that those low-income residents pay to the HOC. I just don't know. But they're choosing to continue the fight rather than to sit down and say, how can we work something out? Is there a way that we can move the parking lot and reconstitute the burial ground? Is there a way that we can, you know, remove part of the burial ground and move some of the bodies?
Right.
Of a memorial. They have not expressed any interest in discussing these issues.
This, I mean, the level of arrogance, I mean, to have been found for the Supreme Court, for the Maryland Supreme Court, that actually starts their brief off saying there is a burial ground in Bethesda, Maryland called Moses Cemetery that is being desecrated. That's how the Maryland Supreme Court starts its response to the lawsuit. And then you have, of course, Judge Carla Smith, who just courageously talks about the power of this of Moses Cemetery. And for HOC, a public, supposedly public institution, to maintain this kind of arrogance is just unbelievable.
So, you know, what we're forced to do is we're forced to go through the very complicated legal process, which we're doing. We're pursuing the claims. We'll respond to the motion to dismiss. We'll respond to whatever other roadblocks HOC puts up. Because we have an obligation as a society to the least powerful members of our society. And the least powerful members of our society are the people who've passed on. We have no ability to speak for themselves, no ability to protect themselves. So that's what this lawsuit is about. This lawsuit is an attempt to allow the BACC, the pastor of the Macedonia Baptist Church, the descendants of the people who are buried there, to speak for the dead, the people who cannot speak for themselves. So we hope the HOC changes its mind and comes to us and says, let's try to work something out. But if they don't, we're prepared to continue to move forward, to fight for the rights of those people, and to stop cars from parking on top of these bodies every single day.
Steve, I know this is an update, so it's sort of an abbreviated interview, but I know WPFW listeners like to get involved. So how can people get involved? What is it for people who are sitting at home right now and they're just absolutely outraged at a public institution that's refusing to acknowledge what everyone in the world has acknowledged, that they are desecrating an African burial ground, that they're profiting from the desecration of an African burial ground, and that they are literally spitting any notion of humanity in the face. What can we do? What can the public do?
So I would encourage them to use their First Amendment rights under the United States Constitution. Mm-hmm. They can write to and call and visit their elected officials, their state elected officials, and urge them to put pressure on HOC to do something. They can write to HOC. If they want to protest HOC or protest outside the parking lot in some way, they can do that as well. But there are a lot of paths under the First Amendment to make your views known. If you're offended by something that is being done by a governmental agency or a quasi-governmental agency. So I'd urge people to speak up. And Marcia, I know you and BACC have been working for years in an activist way with respect to this. They can get in touch with you. They can follow your leadership on this, or they can work independently, but they should make their views known, because what's going on is simply unacceptable in a democratic society.
Yeah, it's not even a democratic society. It's any kind of society. I mean, there is no society on the face of the earth that rationalizes and justifies desecration of a burial ground, period. I mean, even our four-legged friends do that.
Yeah, on that point, I might disagree with you. There are countries around the world who have historically showed great disdain for, you know, burial grounds, mass graves, scenes of genocide and mass killings. But here we're in a society.
But those are the. I mean, yeah. I mean, people have done it, but no one justifies it. Maybe that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's hard to really write a thesis on the justification of desecration. It's
here. There's an easy route. HLC
yes.
is a quasi-public agency. Protest HLC.
Yes.
To the Montgomery County elected officials, write to Governor Moore, who I'm sure cares deeply about these issues, and ask for his help, because we want to sit down with HLC and we want a resolution where that burial ground is reconstituted, where the people buried under that parking lot are properly memorialized, and where they're shown the dignity in death that many of them were not shown in life. So use your First Amendment rights.
Well, as usual, thank you so much, Steve, for appearing on the show. I'm always, you know, encouraged when I hear you talk about this issue. This struggle is in such great hands, as it has been for the last 8 years. We're so grateful to you. And we look forward to your next update and obviously your next court victory, because every time you take us to court, we win. So thank you. Thank you so much, Steve, for all of your hard work. And also for just the love of humanity that you've shown through this struggle. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Marsha, for your kind words. Have a good day.
Have a great day. Thank you so much. So my next two guests are Latrita Houston and Rebitha Moses. And they're going to talk about, we've talked about Moses Cemetery in terms of how HLC treats our ancestors, our people in the spiritual realm. But now let's move on and talk about how HLC treats those of us who are still alive. And so, Latrita, I know that you've had a lot of experience with HLC. And one of the questions that you heard me ask Attorney Lieberman was, where's the money coming from? I mean, there's only so much money that all these agencies have. So if they're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to fight a little group called BACC, Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition, isn't that money that they could spend supporting those of us who are still alive and who need assistance from a public agency like HLC? So first of all, thank you, Latrita and Rebitha, for appearing on What's at Stake. Why don't we first just talk a little bit, Latrita, about your relationship to HLC. I mean, can you just give us a summary of what happened?
So we moved here in the year of 2018. We have seen a whole bunch of property managers. Like, it's like no one ever stays within HOC when it comes to the property manager parts. We have seen so many of their employees disrespecting some of the tenants, including myself, as far as one where an actual HOC employee jumped out of her truck because I asked her at that moment, can you please remove yourself from our parking space that we pay for where we live? She got angry. She jumped in front of the truck, hitting the hood of the truck. Where's your number? Where's your number? Yelling. I mean, it was just, I could not believe the behavior. And when I told HOC what happened, they tried to give an excuse about that and said, okay, well, if this did happen, we will talk to our staff. There has just
been,
no, not at all. There's been so many times where I just wonder why they treat people the way that they do. It's like they prey on the weak, the sick, the disability, like I am. Mm-hmm. And then the people that have no voice.
Mm. And
terrible. It's absolutely terrible when I have neighbors coming to me saying, well, they're not answering their phones. How do I get in touch with them? And that's the same problem I also have with them. That's also where I'm at now, as far as, you know, me being injured by them. They're not trying to take responsibility for it. They're throwing all types of things into this that just does not make any sense at all, instead of just owning up to it. I mean, we were even offered money to basically stay out of the courts. I mean, I'm just not understanding. I thought this area of where we live, you know, it was kind of like told to me that it's a very nice area. People are very respectful and everything else. And when we first got here, it kind of was in that way. But as the property managers kept changing, we saw a lot of different things that were not pleasant at all. Just a lot of things. And I brought up these concerns to other people. And what's being done about it? Nothing. It's like it's being ignored. I feel like there's too much of a buggy with HOC and some of the county. I really do. I feel like there's a buddy system where, you know, this one is cool, this one is cool, I'm gonna protect that one. That's what I feel. I'm not understanding within my own situation why you keep dragging us to court for something you know you caused. It's just not right. Me and my family of five have been suffering since 2023. And it's unacceptable, everything that we have been. HOC almost my life. Like, it is ridiculous going on. And I'm also going to say that for the families out there, I know you're terrified. I've heard. I know that, you know, you feel like you have sometimes no hope because you don't want to be retaliated against. I'm going to tell you right now, I've been retaliated against so many times. I've told them to their face, give a damn what you do to me or my family. My God is bigger and he will on this along with my family, all of us together, because the retaliation, all the things that they've been doing, my family and other people, it's gonna come out soon because someone, I feel like, is just covering all this stuff up so nobody knows what's going on. I have a TikTok. I put on there what's going on. There have been people that have responded to me and said, well, you know, God is in a place to talk for others that cannot talk for themselves. And that's exactly what I'm trying to do. But I'm also going through my own struggles with being sick. Not only did they alter my life, they cost me my job for me being in the hospital. They cost my husband his job. After I lost mine, he went out trying to get a whole nother job. He finally had it. And then they basically told him, because we're fighting HOC, that the job is no longer his after he had gotten an offer and everything else. It's just not right. It is not right what they are doing. I've spoken up so many times, even to the executive. I've spoken up. I'm not sure what else to do. And while we keep continuing to go to court and hear the same thing over and over, I mean, it's just... it's a mess. It's an absolute mess. And I really wish somebody would step it up, because there have been people involved with me, you know, as far as some county people that are trying, but they know that I'm so frustrated about what's going on I don't get what's going on. I really don't. We need
let me bring Babitha Mustith in for a second. Babitha, are you there?
Hey, Marcia.
And you know, this is absolutely heartbreaking what we're absolutely hearing this morning. Indeed. About the treatment of Latrida by HOC. And you're an advocate for women who are going through this kind of struggle. Can you add your voice in terms of, you know, what you're also hearing from particularly Black women, I think, about the way they're being treated?
Absolutely, Marcia. Thank you so much for having me back. Yeah, so I actually met, you know, Mrs. Holston, you know, a while back. And when I found out about her story, I mean, it was really heartbreaking. And it goes to show how HOC disregards Black lives in death and while they're living. I've come across a lot of people doing, while advocating, that are HOC recipients, as Mrs. Holston mentioned, that are disabled, low income, marginalized community, that rely and depend on HOC for a place to live. And what HOC has been doing, from my understanding, from what I've been hearing, is that they have constantly retaliated against residents. I mean, it is horrible. I've heard a lot of other horror stories. And, you know, Mrs. Holston, you know, being, I mean, she's now, you know, wheelchair bound because they had a brown recluse infestation that HOC did absolutely nothing about. And
I'm sorry, what kind of infestation?
A brown recluse spider.
Oh.
Yes. And, you know, she almost lost her life.
Oh my God.
And she was in severe sepsis. But the more and more I talk to people about HOC, the more and more I hear how they're so afraid to speak up because they might not have anywhere else to go.
Right, right.
So HOC, they seem to be preying on the weak, the marginalized, the underserved communities.
Right. Latrida, this is such a difficult story. I'd love to have you come back so we can really get more into the detail. We only have a minute left of this interview, but if you could just tell us, you know, Babitha just told us that you're in a wheelchair now. You weren't in a wheelchair when you first started working with HOC, and how did this happen?
No, I was not in a wheelchair. I was not. I'm sorry.
No, it's quite all right. I understand. And this is not theory for you. This is your life. And we are just so sorry that you're in this situation. And I can tell you that the entire WPFW family is upset right now with the way you've been treated. Babitha, can you tell us what is it that we can do to help victims like Latrida fight against HOC and the kind of treatment that has, you know, caused her so much pain and suffering?
Yes, absolutely. I can leave my email for people to reach out to me that really want to help recipients of HOC vouchers and any HOC tenants. My email is R, my last name Moses, Moses, 91 at gmail.com. And we encourage all the current residents, tenants of HOCs, if you suffered any kind of discrimination, violation, threats, anything, please reach out to me. So we can really get a movement going. And if there are any attorneys out there, please reach out to us because we really need to take a stand for our most vulnerable people in the community.
First of all, let me thank you, Abitha, for your hard work and your courage for fighting for not only yourself, but fighting for others. And Latrita, my heart goes out to you and your family. I know this was a very difficult interview, and we will stand with you on the battle front. This is, you know, the BACC is obviously fighting to stop them from desecrating our ancestors. But we understand the link between that and the way they treat the living. It's there's almost no difference. And so we will stand with you, and we thank you for coming on the show today. And we'd love to have you and Rabitha come back and give us an update and let us know what's going on. Do you have any closing words for us, Latrita?
I would just like to say thank you also for having me. And thank you, you know, for the invite. I'm really sorry you guys are going through what you're going through. I mean, it's like waking up to a total nightmare. I'm grateful to be waking up, but to do it all over again, and half of the time I can't even take care of myself like I should be able to, or my kids. It's just not fair. It's not for other people. It's not fair, because I'm not just going to speak up on myself. It's other families that are really going to actually talk.
Right. Well, I think maybe what we need to do is to devote a show to talking about this, so that we can have a really in-depth conversation about the way the Housing Opportunities Commission treats its clients. I think that you're called clients for them. And for us, we call you neighbor and friend. So we will have a show about this. I want to thank both of you.
Thank
you so much, Latrita Houston. Thank you for appearing on What's at Stake. And we will continue this conversation. I promise.
Absolutely.
You.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much. We will take a short break for community announcements.
Peace! This is your social justice calendar for the week of February 24, 2025. Wednesday, February 26th is Pan-African Community Action's next Asada Shakur Study Group Session, a screening of the documentary The Pendleton Two, They Stood Up, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Black Workers and Wellness Center on 2500 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C. More info can be found on PACA social media, PACADMV. Thursday, February 27th, from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m., there will be a National Reentry Network for Returning Citizens Advocacy Training located at 733 11th Street, Northeast Washington, D.C. More info can be found on the nationalreentrynetwork.org. Also on Thursday, February 27th at 6:30 p.m., Sankofa Video Books and Cafe will hold a discussion on the book Trinity of Fundamentals by Wissam Rafidi and plans for further liberation of the Palestinian people. Friday, February 28th, there is a talk with visiting Cuban Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, Carlos Fernandez de Cosio, at the Institute for Policy Studies from 4 to 5 p.m. RSVP is required. More info can be found on ips-dc.org/events. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm your host, Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo. Our next guest is Dr. Kendrick B. Robertson, a National Vice President of the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE. He oversees AFGE's Women's Department and AFGE's Fair Practices Department, WFP. WFP works to protect and advance civil rights, human rights, and women and workers' rights in the federal and DC government. He was elected to the position in August 2024 at AFGE's 43rd National Convention in Las Vegas. Just as a side point, AFGE is the largest federal employee union, representing more than 800,000 workers in the federal government and the government of the District of Columbia. Dr. Robertson, obviously federal workers right now are front and center in terms of the Trump administration. And every day we're listening, quite frankly, to horror stories about the way federal workers are being treated. And as a former federal government worker from EPA, I'm just, my heart goes out to all the federal workers in our listening community. So can you explain to those who argue that federal government workers shouldn't be treated any differently than any other workers out there? Workers, face, firings, workers face all kinds of different problems, but federal government workers have always been sort of insulated. I mean, federal government jobs have always been considered safe jobs. Once you get a good federal government job, you're basically good for life until retirement. But that's changed now under this administration. So can you make a case for federal workers and the kind of work that they do that's so important to this country?
Yeah, I love that you brought up about American government being safe jobs. And the reason that they were considered safe jobs is not because people didn't get fired or let go. They were considered safe jobs because there were processes in place. There were laws enacted that were specifically designed to make sure that those workers were protected, right? That they were able to bring up those complaints, those issues that were impacting them, and know that they would have those issues heard. But now we've seen this administration, they are entering a tactic of demonizing workers. They have a mass firing of workers. They're dismantling civil rights departments where workers can find those protections, right? This administration is eliminating high-performing employees. This administration is attempting to dismantle our agencies from the inside. And this administration is making the claims of bringing back meritocracy while eliminating the very institutions that legally ensure we have in America where financial decisions are not based on someone's identity. They claim that they are going to run America like a business with their number one goal of boosting profits to private industries. But my question is, who's going to tell these people that America literally does not run without the work that we do? Right. Newsflash, the government is not a business. The government's not for sale. And the government's number one priority is not boosting the profits for shareholders. Right. Our workers and the American government's number one priority is the health and safety of the American people, both domestically and abroad. And that's the case for these federal workers.
That's very well said. Let's talk about DEI. You mentioned it a little bit earlier. And of course, one of the crosshairs of this administration is quote unquote diversity, equity, and inclusion. And under the Trump administration, federal funds are being withdrawn, removed from any programs that deal with DEI. Can you please address how AFGE is dealing with the issue of basically erasing DEI from the architecture of the workplace in this country?
Yeah, so this administration on the campaign trail and currently, they use this tactic where they say something that is not true over and over and over and over again until the public starts to believe, well, if they keep saying it, then it must be true. Right. This is the same thing that we saw with the election denial claims that led to the riot on the Capitol. And this is what we're seeing now with DEI. Right. We're seeing that They're saying, hey, we're going to get rid of DEI. We're going to go back to a meritocracy. But here's the truth. The truth is the American government workers, though our workforce, we have the lowest racial pay gaps and the lowest gender pay gaps because we already hire based on merit. We do not hire based on anyone's identity. That was not a thing. In fact, the reason that this is so incredibly important is what DEI programs actually did and what they would do. So I like to use this example of if you owned a business, right? If you employed people and you sent out a recruiter to the nearby university, and that university was had primarily white students, then all of the people who applied for your job would be primarily white, right? Because that's where your recruiter went. And a DEI program says, well, hey, why don't we go ahead and expand this opportunity? So instead of just going to this one primarily white institution, let's go ahead and send a recruiter as well to a historically Black college or university. Now our applicant pool has expanded and we now have more applicants, Black applicants in this case, and we have more applicants or the same amount of applicants that we have from the first university. And they're all competing against each other. And so when that process happens, you automatically end up getting more opportunities to have more Black folks that will be employed in your job, but they still had to compete. So there's no such thing in the government as a diversity hire. These are quality people. These are quality hires, right? And that's what a DEI program does. It expands the opportunities to the applicants, but the applicants still got to compete for those jobs. And that's the part that's not being told in this tactic that they have of trying to undermine our federal workforce.
Why not just talk about the history of white supremacy? I mean, it's interesting because so oftentimes when we, you know, when we're engaged in these kind of academic discussions, you know, we're on their side of the chessboard where we're playing, I guess it is, I'm not into football, defense, you know, where we're trying to argue against them, right? But the reality for the majority of the history of this country, white people have not had to compete. That is what the fundamental basis of white supremacy is that your white skin provides the passport and the merits behind the white skin is less important than the fact that you represent a particular tribe in this country, right? So under DEI, it just means that everyone has to compete and that just being white doesn't give you a free pass to a job.
Absolutely, right? I mean, anybody who's very honest about American history, and it doesn't take much to be honest about American history, knows that people of color and Black people in particular, but all of people of color were put into a class of American citizenship where they weren't allowed to have that equal access to jobs and equal access to careers, even when they had the qualifications, even when they had the years in service, even when they had the education, they were being denied based on their skin. And so we had to actually be proactive and create laws and policies and programs that eliminated the discrimination based on skin, on someone's identity. Right. That's something that's why these programs existed. And that's why we've been able to see the levels of disparities between races when it comes to income disparities go down, because we're able to say, hey, we have programs in place to make sure that you give these folks a fair shot at this job. And if they meet the criteria, if they exceed all expectations, they have the education that they need, the work experience, they get the job and they're not denied based on their identity. And now we're rolling back those programs because the tactic is to just say something that's not true over and over and over again until people believe it. They say DEI is getting people into these jobs that are not qualified and they only got the jobs because they're a person of color or they're a woman or something like, or they're a part of the LGBTQIA plus community, right? That's the only reason that they got these jobs, when that is not true. All those programs did was say, hey, we're going to make sure we have a more competitive process. And if these folks went out, these folks who have, who are people of color, these folks who are women, if they went out, then that's because they were the best candidate for the job. That's what we actually have for the federal government. And they're trying to roll that back.
Yeah, but when you talk about make America great again, you wonder what period of history the president is really talking about. But let's move on to Elon Musk. Now, Elon Musk heads the Department of Government Efficiency. And on February 22nd, 2025, he tweeted, quote, consistent with President Trump's instructions, all federal employees will shortly receive an email requesting to understand what they got done last week. I guess that's Afrikaans or English. I'm not sure. Failure to respond will be taken as a resignation. So, and so your national president, Everett Kelly, issued the following statement, quote, once again, Elon Musk and the Trump administration have shown their utter disdain for federal employees and the critical services they provide to the American people. Can you discuss Mr. Musk's role in the displacement and termination of federal employees across the country?
Yeah, absolutely, right. This administration has already shown that they have no regard for great and high quality performance of federal workers, as they just recently fired thousands of workers who had outstanding performance, right? These were workers who, some of which just got promoted. And because you got a promotion, they were in a probationary position and had years of service, years of great service and dedication to the United States of America, and then were outright fired because they were in a probationary status under the false pretenses that they didn't meet their performance goals, which doesn't make sense, right? And then for the email that you brought up, right? There are a lot of people saying, well, it's just five bullet points, right? It'll only take you a few minutes. But here's the issue, right? If high performance workers are already being unjustly terminated, then what should be written in response to Elon Musk's email and five bullet points about what was done last week? What are the standards that the bullet points will be judged against? Who is judging them? And who is verifying that what is written is valid? And if no one is judging or verifying these bullet points, then what's the reason? And I have an answer to this. I'll tell you the reason. It's to create chaos and traumatize. But don't take my words for it. See, OMB's new director name is Vaught, right? One of the key personnel in the United States government, his name is Vaught. And he stated, or I should say, he's one of the chief architects of Project 2025, and they appointed him into this position. And he stated, and I quote, we want the bureaucrats to be traumatically affected. When they wake up in the morning, we want them to not want to go to work because they are increasingly viewed as the villains. We want their funding to be shut down. We want to put them in trauma. He said this in high definition video. He said it in HD, right? A self-proclaimed goal to villainize and traumatize can only be explained as evil. I'm gonna say it again. A self-proclaimed goal to villainize and traumatize can only be explained as evil. And that is what this is. And that is what we're up against.
Wow. So what is the relationship between, and maybe you've already described this, but what is the relationship between I'm not an employment attorney, but seems to me these are unlawful terminations, right? I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. So what is the relationship between the unlawful terminations and the implementation of Project 2025?
Project 2025 gave a blueprint of what the Trump administration would do if they were in power. And as much as the Trump administration tried to distance themselves from it, we kept trying to tell folks that, hey, this is the blueprint that he and his administration are going to use, right? And like I said, the chief architect is the one who is now appointed to one of the highest levels in the federal government, and his goal is to traumatize and villainize. And so the idea of finding probationary employees because they don't have the same level of protections as people who are not on probation because they just started working, they're in that period, they went and attacked those folks who were the most vulnerable. And that's kind of where they're trying to get their legal grounding. Now, we at AFGE maintain that what they're doing is unjust and is not legal. And that's why we're battling them in the courts right now.
Now, let's move to Social Security. And we're not going to be able to get to all the different areas today, obviously. So, maybe we should, you know, schedule another visit in 4 weeks when I have my next show.
Sure.
Social Security. So what is your prediction on how the Trump administration will impact Social Security? So Elon Musk and his Dodge team now have access to the personal data of every American in the Social Security system. And everyone is saying this is unprecedented. I mean, no one has ever had that kind of power before. And it puts both individual privacy and the future of Social Security at risk. So what kind of challenges will employees who work for this agency face? And what kind of challenges do you predict millions of Americans will face?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, just on the worker side, right, I can say off the top that they yesterday, you know, at the end of yesterday, they actually disbanded their department on civil rights and equal opportunity. That's what they did as of yesterday. They disbanded it, right? Put all of those employees onto administrative leave and told them to turn in their badges so that they could potentially be recalled back at some point in the future. But as of right now, they're not coming into work, right? Which means that this is the office that handles reasonable accommodations, processes reasonable accommodations for employees with disabilities. This is the office that investigates alleged discrimination. This is the office that investigates when there are sexual harassment claims or there are harassment, workplace harassment claims and bullying. All of those things come through this department and they just disbanded it, right? And so they're setting the stage where workers don't have a way to pursue discriminatory acts against them, right? And that's one of the issues that we are seeing just off the top, right? But then, of course, you have the broader issues like what you're talking about where Elon Musk has access to all of this private data, and we don't necessarily know what his intentions are with this data, but we do know that, like I said earlier, he has this tactic of taking anecdotal data. That's data that, you know, represents a very small number of cases. And then he presents it as if it's a widespread issue, if it's an issue at all, right? Social Security has many checks in place to make sure that the people who are receiving checks are alive, that they are or that they are eligible for what they are receiving, right? And there's so many checks and balances to ensure that we are providing the elite service to the American people. But if you let Elon Musk tell it, he would say that we were not engaging in any of these backstops and checks. And that's kind of the tactic, just continue saying lies over and over and over again until people start to think that those lies are the truth.
We only have two more minutes left and there's still so much to get to in terms of the government. USAID, for example, we can't allow you to leave without talking about USAID because that has been front and center. And so you and your allies have vowed to continue to fight against this administration's illegal effort to shut down USAID. So you've had some challenges within the courts around that issue. Some of the courts have not seen this issue the same way you have. How are you dealing with these court setbacks, these judicial setbacks?
Yeah, right. So we are actually finding different avenues to address similar issues across the board. So we are taking action in the courts, but it's not just one court, right? We're looking at different avenues to bring up these cases. And it's really important, right? And as we're approaching time here, right, one of the big issues that we have to deal with, including with USAID and many of our other agencies, is educating the public on what these agencies actually do, right? And that's one of the biggest issues, because right now the American public has been in the dark so long about what American public does that they're mistaking candlelight for sunlight. And like moths to a flame, they are being drawn in, not realizing that the American people are about to get burned. And so we've got to make sure that people know what we do and why what we do is important and what's going to happen if our services are taken away.
Well, I want to thank you so much. This has been a very enlightening interview. Thank you. Very enlightening interview. Love to have you back again next month to continue this discussion. And we will continue to stay on the battlefield to fight for no fear in the federal government. So thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks to all of our guests, Attorney Steve Lieberman, Dr. Kendrick Robertson, National Vice President of the American Federation of Government Employees, Latrita Halston, and Rabitha Moses. Thanks to executive producer, Ms. Verna Avery Brown. The program is engineered by Mr. Michael Nasella. I'm Marcia Coleman Adebayo. We are celebrating the 22nd anniversary of the passage of the No Fear Act, the first civil rights whistleblower law of the 21st century. WPFW salutes whistleblowers.
Hello, I am Von Martin, host of Caribbeana here on Saturdays, 6 p.m. until 9 p.m. on WPFW. For the 48 years I've been on WPFW Radio, I do feel so humbled with the response of you, our listening audience, with your wonderful reaction to our fundraising efforts. On behalf of the staff and management and the volunteers who continue to bring you excellent programming of jazz and jazz extensions with strong public affairs and relevant news, I say thank you. It is such a wonderful reality as we embrace this changing world to be kept abreast and in tune with what is so relevant to our lives and your awareness upkeep. Stay tuned, keep hope alive, and keep listening to us on WPFW, Washington, D.C.
On Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight for 24 hours, WPFW presents One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world in commemoration of International Women's Day. The programming will center the voices of women and girls protecting their communities and resisting imperialism, racism, xenophobia, and homophobia across the globe. That's One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at wpfwfm.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
On Thursday, February 27th, the Howard University Department of Political Science and Howard U. Kwame Ture Society present the event Revolution in These Times, a Black Liberation Book Talk, with veteran Black Panther Party member, Black Liberation Army leader, and former political prisoner Daruba Bin-Wahad, who will deliver an analysis on how today's resurgent right-wing agenda is an outgrowth of the ongoing and historical political struggle and what fight-back strategies should look like. That's Revolution in These Times, a Black Liberation Book Talk, Thursday, February 27th, 6 to 8 p.m. in the Howard University's Douglas Hall, Room 221 at 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest, D.C. More information and registration for this event can be found on the webpage daruba@howard.eventbrite.com. That's D-H-O-R-U-B-A at howard.eventbrite.com. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Diversity Fund is a grassroots grant source for changemakers of color in the nation's capital. We fund social justice work by and for DC people of the global majority. The deadline for submissions is Friday, March 21st. Details and application information